When we discussed what I should talk about, Nathan suggested that I might explain why it's useful. And that relates not just to language, but to the study of Tibetan culture. And I'd like to point out that it's relevant, as you probably know, it's not just Tibet, but it's a history of Central Asia as well we're dealing with the Himalaya, which is actually a very large area of Eurasia. Besides, there is the Buddhist tradition, which is even larger and older, which is also a thing that you can study through Tibetan. You do that through philology, which is the study of culture in written sources, and that has given rise in other cultures to the birth of linguistics. I feel in Tibetan we are still sort of in labor to produce this birth, in the sense that we're a lot of things in philology we still have to sort out. At the same time, we're doing the grammar of Tibetan. So this relates to how the troubles we experience in text and the trouble we experience in grammar, they have not sort of quite sort of come together the way they come together in, say, Sanskrit studies or Greek or Arabic or Chinese. So that is something we are continually dealing with, same for me when I do my research. Then there's a linguistic aspect to our research, which is that the language is interesting in itself and for its relation to other languages of the of the language family, Sino-Tibetan or Trans-Himalayan, and the aerial aspects of Tibet, which is say half Central Asian and half Himalayan in its typological features. Then it's very nice for linguistics to have a language that's really different and has a long written record. Like Tibetan is one of a few languages other than the big ones we all know, where you can study a history of the language very well. And that's all the more interesting because the language is not very well standardized. We see language variation in every aspect and every layer of Tibetan text. I'll get back to language variation more often.
You can put the mouse up there if you like.
Ah, yeah, thank you. So, a problem which you'll probably be aware of is that language used in Tibetan is very much dependent on the genre, the style, the author, the period, the transmission, if a native editor decides that the text could be better, right? I suppose that even experienced readers of Tibetan have every now and then this experience that you start with a text and you wonder what is going on there because you do not understand, and then for a while if you sort of meditate on it, then it all sort of drops in place and it turns out to be right, Tibetan after all as we know it. But it does take sort of a flexibility of adaptation that it's sort of part and parcel of dealing with Tibetan. And that goes pretty deep in the sense that it really affects the grammar. If you don't know what text you're dealing with, what period or what genre or how this particular author is doing it, then you may be lost or you may miss the point. We always ask, so who uses which features of the language and when and where and why? These are basically like philological questions that relate to culture. And the last question, how do they do it? As in, what are sort of the linguistic particulars of what they're doing? That is what I'm trying to do, right? So that's just a tiny aspect of this whole sheet is what I'm actually aiming for. So one thing that is tremendously important for us is to distinguish text in historical periods and to some extent in genres, well, but within the historical layer we're dealing with. That should be pretty obvious that we have all Tibetan with inscriptions and manuscripts from Central Asia. In my perception, and I share that with Nathan, I believe only the archaeological findings count as old Tibetan and not what anyone says is old, but is transmitted recently. Not even when there is an old Tibetan scrap of text that may have something similar. It's not old Tibetan if it doesn't come from the archaeological context, right? We had this issue recently again with the Bashe, which is sort of, you know, semi-old in the sense that there's actually one passage that was found in old Tibetan manuscripts. It doesn't mean the whole Bashe is old Tibetan because we cannot check, right? And it's not that easy to imitate for Tibetans, old Tibetan, because they don't know what's going on there. It would be pretty easy, I think, to do a spot forgeries. Then there's what I call canonical Tibetan, which is obviously the Kanju and the Tenju. It's in my terminology, not classical Tibetan, because classical Tibetan is a completely meaningless term. Nobody knows what you're aiming for if you say, oh, I study a classical Tibetan text, right? That could be the 14th Dalai Lama. It could be, the first emperor of Tibet. It could be anyone. And so it's meaningless, and it will stay that way because there is no standard that defines classical Tibetan as you should use these rules or that text as example. Every sect has its own language, right? Nonetheless, there is a form of standardization in the canonical text, which is orthography, obviously, which sort of is what old Tibetan was already sort of gravitating towards, and that was sort of codified, how they spell, and their technical terminology, the so-called new terminology. Some people translate it as new language, as if they had invented a new language, which is impossible and implausible, and it's not what they're saying, right? They're saying we have established now the right words for dealing with Buddhist technicalities, and not if you say go out, then you should use this word or something like that, right? They do not prescribe a particular grammar. It means that if you imitate it and you don't know what you're looking for, that you will not reproduce the same language, right? Which is indeed what they never did. They can recycle technical terminology and talk about Buddhism, but you cannot reproduce a canonical text, of the grammar of a canonical text, if you do not study it as grammar. That means that there is no standard. We like that as linguists because it means that we're dealing with real language, right? It's not like a Lego or something. It's growing, right? It's an organic thing that happens, which is beautiful, but it's also maddeningly complex, of course. Yeah. Then if Tibet starts being original in the sense of producing own texts again, then it's localized texts, right? They deal with Tibet and with Tibetan Buddhism, and authors are using their own language, which is really different from old Tibetan and also from the canonical language. Everyone has read a bit of sort of, say, Tibetan from the 12th century onwards, and it's not sort of dealing with an obscure, you know, like a Panju-like subject. Then it's a more colloquial style. And there's actually very little evidence, I think, if you look at those texts like the Kyelrap or Milarepa and then some lesser known texts, that they're not even trying to be canonical or something. That's not just not what they're aiming for. So I don't think it's a normative thing that's going on there. With other texts, they can be just as interesting, of course, for us, but one reason to take these two texts as important is because they had a very wide or large audience, right? As soon as you get to something like, say, the Chöjung of Buten or something like that, then it's prestigious, but nobody ever read it then, right? I mean, so it's not influential. Whereas Milarepa has obviously been influential, and Kyelrap as well. So the footnote about Tibetan is what we just covered, or about classical is what we just covered. We are now going to, is this correct? Yes. Now, I do my thesis on the verb, you know, and as Nathan said, the verb is nice because it's just interesting. This is where it happens, right? This is where it happens. I mean, if you, nothing happens without the folk, right? So you better, it's just like straight to the happening. If anyone ever says like Tibetan is a monosyllabic language, then you have never really looked at the verb, because I mean it attracts all sorts of other things that sort of that stick to the verb stem, right? So before you know, you have a verb that is five syllables long, actually. So nothing monosyllabic about that. What I have done here is to start with what comes before the verb but still belongs to it. I call it a pre-verb. That's obviously not in the Sanskrit sense, but it's something that belongs to the verb and is put before, so it's pre, right? And, a polarity prefix, which is part of the verb, you cannot separate it, right? In verse, you'll never separate a negative from the verb stem, right? It's just not possible to put that on the next line, or to put a yang or a ni in between. This is a unit. So that's a prefix. A normalizing suffix, you see that all the time in Tibetan, of course, because it's characteristics of umpa lumpa rhythm, right? That's it's every other syllable is pa or po, etc. And also with the verb. I do not take this as a non-verb because it has a pa, because as you know, when they're actually using it, yeah, and that's actually the same for an English participle, so it's not specifically to that. Next thing is something you will not recognize by the term, but you'll know it, that a verb can end in pa dang or something like that, and then the pa dang is what I call a modalizer. These are the things that connect everything together, right? So in a way, these are even more interesting than verbs, because they're sort of the verbs for the verbs. Right? Then there can be a modal affix in that, of course, in the same slot. And if the sentence doesn't end there, you can have a clitic, as in a concessive conditional. You can have like a verb na yang, and it's even if, right? It's another slot. And then you get auxiliaries, which is even nicer than ordinary verbs. But this constitutes a new verb, and the whole thing starts from the top, right? So this is why we skip from 3 to 6. There will be a 4 or 5 in between, actually. Then you can have a pre-verb and polarity prefix in the vocabulary as well. The trouble is, how do you know if an auxiliary is a verb that is an auxiliary? Because anything can be an auxiliary, right? I don't know yet. In the sense that I have some verbs, I know they are auxiliaries, but I cannot sort of formally prove which are proper auxiliaries and which are not. I don't think it's a problem. It's a verb is used often enough, and I describe it for that reason, that it may be of use to other people. Then what more could you possibly want, right? I mean, like, probably more people would consult grammar that way than for the theoretical argument whether it's auxiliary or not, right? So it's actually not a big problem to know whether something is a real auxiliary. It's if it smells like an auxiliary, then you can treat it that way, right? And they will see what happens. Now, one thing that there's in that sense is a zoo. That is the best description of what I currently have in sort of in my laptop is a zoo of auxiliaries, and sets of weird animals, and there may be a taxonomy to it, right? But it's sort of something I'm still sorting out. One thing auxiliaries can do is that they restrict choice in polarity, which is say you cannot put every negative before a verb stem that has an auxiliary. If you have an auxiliary like nu to be able to do something, you cannot say. I'm quite capable of not being in time, or something like that, right? That's not possible, right? Because you don't say that in Tibet that way, right? And they can also restrict the verb stem, of course, and whatever follows, right? Some verbs take something in between here, and others do not. Okay, now we start from the beginning of this string. I'm telling you, showing you how I sort of try to attack the verb with the slot minus two, the preverb. Why would you believe in preverbs at all? If if you know what the components mean, then you may not need preverbs at all, right? The simplest thing is when you serialize them, you get two verbs that mean more or less the same, and then just work together. This is a common combination in several days. Then you get the combinations where the sum is bigger than the parts, right? Hendia, this is called in Greek. And there we already see, as you just mentioned incidentally, that if you use it as a verb, you actually only reproduce like the second part. For instance, if you say, I don't know whether he gets enlightened or not, you use like and you only repeat the second part. Okay? Then negation comes in between, and other things come in between. But we know that this is just a verb, or was a verb, some, yeah? But it's no longer seen that way. And I think it's fair to say that it's also not the subject. It could be an adverb, but it would be an unusual adverb because it belongs to the stem. So it's a preverb. Yeah. With noun plus verb combinations, even harder, because they look like objects or subjects if it's intransitive, right? So invite is to draw the eye, which is actually quite plausible. It's sort of, you know, if not too literally, then it may work out well. Except that it means definitely something else than the literal sense. This is a semantic argument. We don't like semantic arguments if we can have a better, make a better case, but it's a decent argument. They can be unanalyzable as another not talk, which is just not a combination or a word that you see in other contexts. I think this is related to the word for face, but that's not normally spelled that way, right? Although these pairs belong together, you can put a negation or a question thing even in between them. Right? This is can be found in actual text, of course. Now, there is something interesting if you look at the development of those verbs. MT is Middle Tibetan. This is a line from Milarepa. They invited my teacher, and the teacher doesn't take la. It is treated as a direct object, which is basically I drew my teacher. Right? Apparently, spien is at that time no longer recognized as the object of the verb. It's just part of it. You take another object. Whereas in Old Tibetan syntax, that would definitely be a direct object, and the person is an addressee, takes la. Right? So you get that in the Tsanglun, for instance, which is has been part of the glossing effort. People invite the Buddha all the time. He's a celebrity, he takes la, right? As addressee. So you can actually show that these verbs tend to develop into different things than ordinary verbs. That's the preverb. Now we already saw the negation, which is hardly worth telling much about because you know well. Verb morphology. All I want to point out is that we have four forms at most, and most of the time they're not predictable. And many verbs do not have four forms; they have only two forms, and then all verbs have only one form. This is fascinating for sort of the gory details of morphology when you're a linguist, and otherwise it's just a pain, I think. I mean, Sam was just left, he suffered 2 hours of me explaining, because he was asking, now I want to know about the verbs terms, and okay, then you'll have it. And he thought it was helpful, but I mean, it's also sort of a thing, like where do you start and where does it end? There is a logic to it, but it was not obvious to Tibetans themselves, as you probably know. To put it mildly, they mess around with it, right? In the Middle Tibetan text I'm studying, you see a very clear loss of function and the formal distinctions that go with it. the future forms which are very much alive in Old Tibetan and obviously in the canonical texts as well, because if you eat them for, say, Sanskrit gerundives and things like that, you cannot do without a future stem, right? But they are hardly ever used in Middle Tibetan. It happens. It's not true that they do not occur at all, but productive use is minimal. And the dominant pattern becomes a pass non-pass distinction, which is important because it gives new jobs for the auxiliaries. When you no longer have the future present distinction and you want to make a distinction, then you hire an auxiliary to do it, right? So this is employable. And the modern last side gets even worse because nearly all the distinctions are lost. It depends a bit on how educated the speaker is, I think, but not on how well the language is preserved. Doing it in this order, after all. We have seen two morphemes between the verb stem and a putative auxiliary that allows for four different constructions depending on whether you use a nominalizer or not, or whether you use the terminative or not, if it's a terminative, right? Four options. And these four options are used differently. Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, this is never described in any grammar. Like, you may see examples that fit the pattern, but they do not say you have four options and verbs are used this way or that way or both ways, which is also possible, right? Doesn't happen, right? So a substantial part of my job is just to make these silly schemes and then see whether they actually work, right? And they work surprisingly often, and if not, there's something going on, usually. And you can sort out what's going on, and then you'll have another page or something like that in your PhD, at least so on. But then, you'll see some familiar patterns in the right column with a model auxiliary like nu. You just get it immediately after the stem. When you say go to do something, then it takes a terminative. With other verbs that are more concerned with sort of the propositional value of a complement, you get the par in between. And then a few verbs, that's basically yin and re when it occurs, so that's much later, and dra, that's about it. Take the direct pa to say what they said already without that auxiliary action, right? I give these technical names that I can refer to them, but if you do not know what I'm talking about, just interrupt. In the auxiliary system, now I get to the page I was lost, yeah. So if I take the modal auxiliaries, for instance, these are, say, the auxiliaries, not just modal, the auxiliaries that come directly after a verb stem. You can just, you know, read text and find auxiliaries that do that, right? And you get a very orderly list of what they do and which type of infinitive they take. So nu takes a present stem, if it's a verb that distinguishes present stems, right? And so there's shi in the sense of know how to. Yeah? Know that would be a par complement. Right? And then other verbs take a future stem, like have to do something, etc. And then there's a set of verbs that take a past stem, which are actually not modal auxiliaries, right? They're clearly distinguished as having other functions. So myong might be said to be related to the modals because it's about the agent. These verbs are about the agent. Ability, procedural knowledge or skills or the will to do something, and then Nyong might be said to be agent focused because it's concerned with the experience that someone has and not with the actual result of it, right? But then all the other auxiliaries that have a past stem, they are definitely not modal. The main thing that is sort of important, for instance, for the glossing project or tagging project, is that you can use these auxiliaries to identify what verb stem you're actually dealing with. Right? It becomes a diagnostic. If you know, oh, this should be a future term, then you can actually apply that rule eventually. And now we can cross out options, right? Yeah. So we'll get to this one later. This is perfect if you use it directly after a verb stem, right? Do have verb. That doesn't happen at all in Old Tibetan, and then Gyalrop and Milarepa are rife with perfects suddenly, which is interesting. Like it doesn't even happen before. No. No, a challenge first. Yeah, this is not a construction I may need. Some things are not decidable by syntax. So this is the other share, not know how, but know that. And you can put a par before it and then say know that so-and-so, right? And this one is clearly know that. It has the ngo before it, but it doesn't really matter. It could be without the ngo as well. Is it still legible or would you? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. He recognized that there were ogresses. They were ogresses. But you can have a par before it, which is not a complement clause. It can be just an independent adverbial clause. And it's just like, to know without studying is not to know that studying is not being done or something. Right, this is really a different thing. In practice, you can recognize this fairly easily when you know what text is about. Right? Maybe you never realize that this is actually ambiguous because you will just know this. But it would be ambiguous for a computer, for instance. Right? So not everything is decidable by syntax. When these things. When auxiliaries take this par complements, it's also unclear whether it's a gerund or a complement clause. So what I've been trying to do is to say to see when these complement clauses are consistently used, and that's a very specific range of verbs. That is the ben and the den and the she we already saw. Den and the canonical texts are swarming with the gyurs and the biet, of course, because you can use them to make verbs clearly intransitive or passive or transitive. So it becomes like a voice distinction similar to Sanskrit. Right? I'll get back to that later. And then you can have sort of the next equivalent of make something happen is to let someone else do it. Yeah? So Tibetan emperor and Old Tibetan inscriptions, he nangs all the time, and then that means he doesn't do anything himself. Right? But it belongs to this line. And the same in modern Lhasa, right? You can sort of, if you're polite and you do it well, then you use nang all the time, which is, even if it's not anything sort of permissive. All right. Now I get to something that Nathan tells me not to do usually is to bring some terrible table of information that I have to explain. This is the Middle Tibetan auxiliary system as I understand it. And it contains only two tenses, past and non-past. And it contains three categories that are defined by the type of auxiliary. There is the yin type, there is the chung and yung type, and there is a ye type. You can all do all this without even understanding what is going on. You just see which auxiliaries are the most frequent, and you organize them. So you organize them by the past or present stem of the main verb, and you organize them by type of auxiliary. And then yeah, you can replace with du, for instance. And jung you can replace with song. And yin you can replace with du again. Or with la, of course. And that gives the third dimension. So you have to imagine there's another screen here, another screen there. It has the du and the la and behind the yin. You know? I am not going to demonstrate this scheme. I would like to point out that if you sort of look at it sort of patiently, then it looks actually quite orderly, and it's not such a big deal. And there is one thing that I find particularly nice about the self-organization you get in the scheme. It's not something I invent, I just basically organize my data and the scheme comes up, right? Is I've already mentioned that in Lhasa the past and non-past distinction in the verb stem is lost, right? That would mean that this distinction is lost. And that's exactly what happened, of course, is that they no longer have a future Payin. And instead they use verb Giyin in modern Lhasa, which is easily copied from there to here. So if I read Miguel up, I can explain something about modern Lhasa, which is, I think, quite satisfactory. One thing I will avoid largely is the other screens behind here. Yeah? I would like to concentrate on the yin and the yu here. This would be a simple past, and this would be a perfect. So the difference is that this has once happened, and you know it for a fact, and that's how you convey it to others. This is what happened. This happened. It happened, and I saw it, or I saw it happen. And the perfect would be a state that still obtains in the present. Right. So in a sense, the perfect is fairly close to the present. The next thing I'm going to do is, you can make a perfect of a perfect. A perfect of the verb to be. I skip now to sort of the late end of the development that you see within Middle Tibetan. The normal way to develop a perfect, and this is what happened in English, is that you say something like, you have a car and it's broken and you have the car fixed. And that's exactly how perfects developed in medieval English. You have a transitive verb that you put after a thing you have. You get a perfect. Then at a certain point you can reverse the order and say, I have fixed my car or something like that. And then you can use it with intransitives as well and say, I have been somewhere. This development is something you can see in Tibetan as well. If you sort of periodize with precision, you could make that apparent. I'm not going to do that because it's actually, once you know the trick, it's mainly a question whether you can find the data that match the pattern, but not how it happened. It becomes interesting when they start making perfects of the verbs to be, because these are not supposed to have a past. Right? You can have a verb become for the past, but not a stative verb in the past. So that's a change of category. Remember we had four stems or two stems and then stative verbs which had no past. And now they use it as a past. The interesting thing about it is that when you look in Minarepa and see how it's used, there's only two places where this combination is used. And the first is when Minarepa is born and his father says, oh, now a son has been born to me. It's a delight to hear that news, so my son's name will be delightful to hear. And the difference between this perfect and all the other perfects, because this already makes a perfect, in case that was not clear. Right? So you have a perfect of skiers, and you make a perfect of that perfect. The difference is that he has not noticed it himself, but someone has heard or seen that he has a son, he goes to the father, and that gives another step, and he uses the do after the year. That's what we call a hearsay perfect. And I think it's rather striking that that happens exactly when he is named after the event delightful, or the named after the event like delightful to hear. Right? So a little obscure piece of grammar can get you to the heart of the Milarepa story, which I think is sort of a nice proof that if you sort of know how to look for your needles in the haystack, you can pick them out with some precision. The other example in Milarepa where it happens, this same combination, is not with a short infinitive, but with the nominal infinitive. This is the earlier step. If you have I have fixed my car step, then that would, in Tibetan, also take the pa first before it becomes one thing. And this is the point where Milarepa gets his magic to take revenge on his uncle and aunt. And I think it's also a turning point in the story because his story would not be validated if it weren't for someone checking for the Lama whether Milarepa told the truth, coming back to the Lama, and then giving the Lama sort of reason by testimony that he was true, he was right. And then the Lama repeats that himself and he says, "You have been," and then I have to add, "proven true," right? And this is a second turning point in the story, like his actions are validated at that point, and then later he becomes Buddhist, but first he takes a nice revenge, right? Which is one of the nicer aspects of the story. So if I sort of would sort of transport you back to the first thing, which I will not show you again, is that sort of a very obscure piece of grammar, can you take it to the pivotal points in a story and see how they express that exactly. It's not something that you would want to ignore if you knew it, right? At least I wouldn't. It makes the story better and better written and better understandable and more catchy. Yeah. Now, another thing where I would like to sort of demonstrate the relevance of the grammar for the study of the culture is a similar combination with yin. So it was a perfect of the copula. This is in the Gyalwa. And it's something I have come to appreciate a lot, that Tibetans identify people across different centuries all the time because they're reincarnated and say, "Oh, in that kalpa you were like that, or in that century you were like that." And the Buddha does it all the time. Well, at that time he was that, and then he was that, and she, etc. So they use the copula across centuries all the time, which is something we don't see very often in other languages with people, right? I mean, like, in the 19th century I was, it doesn't happen. Yeah, but the Tibetans do it all the time, right? For me, that's fascinating because usually that sort of knowledge is either strongly asserted or it's something that is discovered, right? And these are things that matter for Tibet. Now, in this case, the monk is practically omniscient, and he says to the king, "Look, you have been a Buddhist before. Well, you didn't know it, but you are a Buddhist." And he uses Yin Duk in the Lhasa text of the Gyalwa. And the Derge text changes that. Now, the Lhasa text is atrocious in its orthography and also in its text edition, actually. But it's very interesting for all the colloquial spellings that it has. And it makes sense for the Lhasa text also to have colloquial grammar aspects. And it's exactly what's going on here, that it's an innovative form. The yin is actually the last thing you would use a perfect for. And it happens nonetheless. And then the Derge edition says, "Well, that doesn't look canonical to me," and it puts a pi, which is fine. You can just look this way with the pi. Yeah. Then it's what? "Oh, it turned out that you were a Buddhist in your previous life," but that's not his point. It's you have been a Buddhist, and that is a past with present relevance because now you have to do something. You have to get rid of the heretic habits that you have. And if you look around in the Gyalwa, you see that you get perfects more often before an imperative. There's a thing in the past, it has present relevance, so act on it. So everything points to the Lhasa edition being the right one here. And you can see that the native editing tradition, which is quite helpful for this text, the Dek edition, is really a good way to read the Gelrab if you don't want to sort it out for yourself, right? But it's not always right. And in this case, it's actually the Lhasa form, which is far more interesting because it's a new thing that happened in the grammar, right? And I just don't recognize it. I'm not sure it's normative, this correction, or maybe the editor didn't have a dialect where this happened, right? This is also an option. And because, you know, they don't do this kind of correction very often. It's usually spelling, and sometimes it changes a kin as a conjunction in a jing. That's definitely more classical, right? But then inserting subordinating things all the time is not a habit of them. Okay, so then I have another text. This is a Vetala story. Where a girl speaks to her lover, that is sort of, yeah, this is the best context to use the word soulmate, because apart from the fact that you have no soul in Buddhism, it's exactly what's going on here. They have been companions or lovers in former lives, and now they meet each other again. They say, although you have been companions in former lives, or we have been, and later the father repeats that. Oh, so you two have been lovers. Well, now it's my turn to decide. Right? I mean, but you see exactly the same situation, a past with present relevance, and it's expressed by doing instead of do, which is nice, because Gyur has a very long history. The very first inscription that we have, Lhasa Gyur inscription, late 8th century, doesn't it? It's not even that late. It takes 760s, right? So it's mid 8th century. And it says, it has a gyur and then a pa and then a den. So it's this construction basically. And it says, it turned out that Bal and Lang were disloyal. Well, it turned out to be true that they were disloyal. And that construction is found with du in the Gyur. But the Gyur is still coming strong in this text, and you get Gyur in the sense of du, a little discovery that's been made here. Now I've become more and more fascinated by the Gyur, and now I'm going to change to another thing. I was wondering what was happening to Gyur. As you probably know, Gyur is very common in the Kanjur and Tenjur texts. If you do a little search action, you get like 40,000 hits, I think, for Gyur, which is very impractical if you want to know something about Gyur, right? Because you cannot sort of study 40,000 examples. Now. Besides, if you just click on one example, you never know where you end up, right? So one moment you're reading it just as like silly Jataka, and the next moment you're in totally obscure tantric thing. And it's an interesting corpus, and but you have to know what you're looking for, because otherwise you get a lot of data you cannot sort of digest, right? So this is not the way to study Gyur. Fortunately, a Japanese scholar, I'm sure you... Inaba has studied the Gyur in translations from Sanskrit and found that it's often used as a passive auxiliary. Now, at a certain point I thought, well, but why should I look at the Sanskrit text if that's actually a kind of evidence that many people do not appreciate? I like Sanskrit a lot, but if you say something about Sanskrit to people who do not know Sanskrit, they think, oh, it's Sanskrit, you don't want to know. So I just pressed the search button in the Kiel app, and it turned out that there were like almost 200 Gyurs there. which is surprising because it's supposed to be a centricism and it's just used productively in their own narratives. Now, part of these 200 are predictions, like this will happen in the future in Tibet, and these I have ignored. But I've looked at all uses where cure is used in the past, with a verb in the past. And I don't have time, and you won't have patience, to discuss all these examples, because these are not even complete examples. But it would be a lot, right? Instead, I have organized them, and this is a little dictionary of how they're used. And it's surprisingly systematic how they're used. First, they're used almost exclusively with intransitive verbs, which are so-called anti-causatives in linguistic parlance. Like be filled always has a causative counterpart, like to feel something, right? And to be born has a counterpart and to produce, etc. You know these pairs probably in Tibetan verb stems. Now, here is used with the intransitives when something pops up or a country is filled or it's something that happens spontaneously and it's very noticeable. So this noticeable is an important feature of it. Now the same thing can happen with disappearance. There's a regular sort of device in the narrative that voices come from the sky in the Gyalrab. This is an Indian narrative thing. It's like a voiceover in documentary, right? It just says like, this is going to happen. And, but then in the Gyalrab, there's also gods that disappear and give comments, and then there's a voice from the sky that does not appear because only a voice, but even that will disappear. And these disappearances, these have gyurs, right? So disappear, gyur. It's also something like, where did it go? Right? So it's actually an event of perception when something disappears. Now, then there are, and there's a curious habit of some supernatural beings to just sink into someone else. There are Taras who sink into Avalokiteshvara, and that's also a disappearance. Right? So I have to try to organize these examples by looking for sort of their semantic similarities, and basically it's popping up and disappearing, and destruction. There's a small class of motion verbs, which are spontaneous motions, like to fall is not someone's action, it happens just like that. Now we get to the interesting part. There are actually persons or protagonists of the story moving, and they use cure nonetheless. But where does it happen? First, there's body hair of the monks. So they sort of have a mystical experience, and their body hair, they're thrilled. And then at a certain point, there are statues that start moving. And then they use cure for the moving. Yeah? So they start moving, and then they make their way to Tibet. And this is apparently sufficiently sort of spontaneous in the sense of non-agentive to use that same cure, right? But it gives also the sense of marvel that we saw with the appearance or sudden disappearance. So there is a very specific range here of situations where gyur is sensible for Tibetans to use in a native story. And it would be interesting to look at the situations where they use it for Sanskrit translations and see how they use it. And not just that they use it for a passive, but which passive or which middle voice. And that may lead to some surprises, I don't know. Now there's the next group, which is rather large, is feelings. These can be physiological feelings, illness, or having a full stomach, and then people rejoice or deplore all sorts of situations all the time. It's basically the king and princess are sort of, this is not happening, or I want, you know, and so these are also spontaneous events in the sense that they are not
willed by anyone.
If you would compare that to, for instance, classical Greek, you would see that to the many verbs of feeling and the verb sentiendi, they have a middle voice, and the middle voice is also used for the passive. So there is a sort of method to this method. So feel bad is also possible. At a certain point, they use a literal verb burn, but it takes hatred as subject, so the hatred is sort of flaming up, and that is good enough for a duel. Yes, and I also record the verbs that sort of that go with, for instance, gu does not occur directly before cure, but it goes in coordination with yirang, which is combined with cure. And then I record this as well. There's all sort of building now. This is almost finished. A little dictionary of forms that occur in particular situations. And then when I find the next auxiliary, I can see, oh, are these verbs also sensitive to that auxiliary or to another situation, etc. So, as with the table I showed you of the modal auxiliaries, what I'm basically doing here is to let Tibetan describe itself. I look for verbs that select other verbs. And when you put it all together, you get the native organization of the grammar. And I'm not sort of posing some sort of latest and hippest theoretical model on it. And you say, well, this is how the Tibetans themselves have apparently organized their language, otherwise it wouldn't work that way. I think it's very satisfactory from a sort of descriptive point of view that you don't have to sort of interfere with your data, but you can let it happen. Sounds rather Taoist. It takes a lot of sort of arranging before it actually fits these sort of tables, but then eventually it seems to work. Then there are lasting mental properties with Gyur. These are basically verbal sentienti, only they're not listed that way in the dictionary, so to say, because it's just verbs to have or to remain in a certain state, but they are used for that type of situations. Then there's a very small number of transitive verbs that use with Gyur. I am not entirely sure what's going on here. In one case, za, eat, is used for to eat doubt, which is to experience doubt, and that's just another verb in the sentiendi, right? To see is also something that pops up, so but a regular transitive verb like to beat or something doesn't happen with cure. Then there is to get, obtain. Well, if you obtain cities, yeah, then that's our arhat. Results, that's hardly a sort of an action, right? This is, again, an event that happens to you and it affects your mind. So they seem to fit the pattern, although they are not sort of kosher verbs of this type. Because these are genuine intransitives. Whereas these are verbs that take an agent, za and tong, top, they take an agent in the ergative, but they do exactly the same kind of thing.
So,
the last thing I should like to mention here is that again we get here, nobody could carry the statues I've mentioned before, and then it turns out that, or perhaps Avalokiteshvara even emanates them or something like that, but suddenly they have a pair of white zop. And it turns out that they can carry it, and you get the gear again. Right? So apparently, and this is a suspicion that's already sort of raised by this use in the Lhasa inscription of the 8th century, gear had an aspect of a semantic aspect to it, which is very close to this whole auxiliary system I'm dealing with, and the reason why it's good to look at sort of the outliers of it is that if I only look what is seen in modern Lhasa of this auxiliary system, then I'll never get to know where it comes from because I only look what I already know, right? So I have to look for other verbs as well, see what they're actually doing. In this case, I think the result is interesting because it can feed back into the people who are patient enough to actually study Sanskrit sources as well and see why are they using gyur here, because they don't use gyur for every passive, and it feeds, on the other hand, it feeds directly into the development towards modern Tibet. So, I can say more about what exceptions that are left. One exception is, I think, clearly something that comes directly from the Kanjiwa. I didn't look it up even. I thought it was so confident that, but it's in verse, and it's someone who's sort of purposely said prayers, and has good chance of becoming a Buddha. And I don't know why it takes the gyur, but I think it's more like a sort of filler for the verse, because it doesn't fit the other patterns. And this one I can explain by the marvel situation. So it turns out that of a huge number of gyurs, there's actually a very specific pattern to it that makes very good sense from a modern perspective and from an old Tibetan perspective, and was not discovered before. I think I should call it quits here, in the sense that I have said what I wanted to say, or it's more or less show by way of example how I go about sorting out how things work, rather than presenting an entire system which is sort of still in sort of status nascendi, because the things pop in and out all the time. There's a lot of viewer happening to me as well. Thank you.